Hello, this is Peter Jacoby for Profiles. Our guest in the studio today is a distinguished musician whose fascinating professional life has included three distinct periods of activity: as performer, as teacher, and as pioneer. James Pellwright capped his performing days as solo flutist of the Philadelphia Orchestra, and what could top that? Well, he followed up with an extended service as professor of flute at Indiana University's Outstanding School of Music, and what could top that? Well, he found a new career as exponent of the Native American flute, which he uses in a novel way, bringing to that instrument the performance approach of a classical musician and also new music expressly written for it. One looks at James Pellwright and sees a happy fellow with a smile on his face and a twinkle in his eye. Welcome, and I guess we should begin with what's got your enthusiasm in such a whirl. Tell us about this Native American flute and you.
As you know, Peter, I retired in 1987 and did manage to stay in Bloomington for a few more years. But in 93, we decided that we would move west. And my wife and I each has been fascinated by the West, the traditions. We each enjoy watching Westerns only for the great scenery of Monument Valley, Death Valley, and the like. So we settled in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and shortly after we settled in, we attended on a July 4th evening an event at the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center, where they featured many of the tribal dances along with drumming. And in particular, I heard for the first time the captivating sound of the Native American flute. This young man didn't play very much. I found out afterward that he actually had found the flute in his grandmother's attic, and they decided they would give it to him to see what he could do with it. So he played for a few moments with the drums and the Taos drums, by the way, in the background. He played maybe no more than three or four different pitches. People around me were saying, "My goodness, when will he ever get off those notes?" And I kept saying to myself, "There must be more notes in there, and what a fantastic sound." It was so exciting. And this was my initial exposure to the Native American flute.
So you moved west, you heard it. That was certainly an element in getting you started. Was there anything else in your past that might have been a factor?
I can't recall, except that I have always been willing to take on diversity in music. I recall, for instance, during my teaching in my teaching career, always being anxious for new music and the trends in woodwind playing. And I feel fortunate to have been so actively involved during the period when we had quartertones, multiphonics, all sorts of different styles of contemporary music. And it encouraged me to begin working with composers. I had many composers write pieces for me for the modern flute. So it would be no different than being exposed to a new sound like this. I had never heard a sound that was so natural. Remember that with the modern flute, we are always involved with attempting to form a sound, create a sound by the embouchure, which is the formation of the blowing hole to get the proper air speed and so on through that instrument. It was always a nightmare when it didn't coordinate the way it should. But here was a flute that I could blow, that suddenly it was magic in return. I would feel tingles up my spine, so to speak. I can't put it any other way. It was really an exciting experience.
And how far do you think you've brought this technique of this old instrument?
I suspect that I've been so busy that it hasn't occurred to me how far I should take it, but I think I've taken it to contemporary circles based on the fact that I've just produced my sixth CD. And actually, with the modern flute, I never got a chance to make one. Although I did make the long play records.
But you also were, of course, part of a big ensemble in those days. But we'll get back to that a little later on. Now, I've read that not being a Native American yourself and not having grown up with a tradition of playing the instrument as they would play it, you've not made an effort to copy that, but to practice it as a classical instrument, and that you often use classical music in your practice sessions.
Can you
talk a little bit about that?
Yes. Perhaps we should backtrack just a minute and simply point out what occurred that perhaps influenced me more than anything else. I met a very prominent Native American flutist in Tucson, Arizona, and he so much as told me that the instrument was not designed to be played in a contemporary fashion, because I intimated that perhaps, since I knew nothing of Indian traditions, that this would be the direction I ought to take. And he immediately objected to that, and he said it's really against all cultural issues relative to Native American music. And, of course, I responded to that by saying that if I do contemporary music, we are not attempting to interfere with the cultural issues of the Native American. We are taking the instrument beyond. Well, he said, if you can do it, go ahead. But he said it's really not designed for that. So, of course, the first flute that I received from my maker, I immediately got to work and found fingerings in it that would lead me into this direction. And as far as methodology is concerned, I had to fashion my own right from the start. So I had nothing but my many years of playing the modern flute to turn to in as many ways as I could.
And you use repertory from the classical music area, right?
Yes, I do. Ironically, none of it is from the flute literature. I decided that how exciting it would be to simply try to play many of these beautiful solos you would hear on French horn, on oboe, on clarinet, the thematic surges of sound from Strauss coming from the strings, the double bass opening of the Firebird Suite, the bassoon solo from the Rite of Spring. So there's really very little for flute that I have taken. So I've stolen from all of the other beauty.
As you wanted to earlier, but couldn't.
Right. Correct.
Well, could we perhaps have you demonstrate for us, first of all, how a Native American might utilize this instrument and make it sound, and then turn it around to what you're trying to accomplish, okay?
Yes, that would be fine. Perhaps we ought to begin with the fact that The flute is built on what is known as the pentatonic scale, five tones. And this would be the extent of it. And those five tones, for the most part, make up many of the tribal tunes that you hear. The octave note, the G at the top, is repeated, but basically we have just the five tones. So what I had to do in order to bring this to contemporary circles was simply to fashion a chromatic scale. And at the same time, we've extended the range another interval of a third, so we have roughly 15 tones that a composer, a contemporary composer, is able to use to create a work in presumably his, her style.
And you just do that with fingering?
Yes, so. By simply half-holing. Maybe the finger may be one-third on the whole or two-thirds.
Well, let's hear the instrument as it might be played, might have been played.
This is just a short fragment from a Northern Plains Indian chant, which would be probably the Cheyenne or the Lakota.
Understand why you got caught. I mean, it's very haunting, isn't it?
Very definitely. It's spiritual. From the moment you begin with the first note until you end, and in many instances, what the flute is transposing, of course, is the tribal chant or the song, depending on what it is that they would be singing. At the end of phrases, you would hear. These would be comparable to the vocalization of, ah. And sometimes the out-of-tune playing is really the most fascinating. But so much for that, because once you hear two, three, four, five of these, they almost begin sounding alike.
So let's hear perhaps a little touch of flute as you are striving to play it.
Immediately, I had to get launched into playing exercises that would enable me to produce more tones and learn the fingerings. So this is where, of course, I did go into flute exercises, something like this. Then, of course, we need to be mindful of the fact that we're doing this on the native flute. So at the end of one of these exercises, I would always include. To remind us that, in fact, it is the native flute playing this, but now in an extended manner. And I personally feel that the spirituality through the half steps are just as inviting as they would be when we are skipping the tones for the pentatonic mode.
Well, now let's listen to a recording that allows us to hear more of this technique that you've been developing. And I understand that what we're going to play from is your first recording on the Native American flute, and that you wrote a piece called Canto. So you might explain to us what it is, and then let's listen to it.
Canto is nothing more than, of course, as you know, translated, it's song. I began, first of all, before I found any more notes, I did dwell on the pentatonic scale and would begin to improvise little melodies, albeit I never went very far because with five tones. So eventually other notes began to creep in the scale, and I began to write many of these phrases down so that I could repeat them again. The biggest problem with improvisation for me is that, first of all, I don't improvise, and if I do, I forget what I played. So this called for some creating phrase elements that maybe might be a composition once you put them all together. And this is the way Canto grew. It was quite a while before it really became a piece, but ultimately I began to insert enough notes that, yes, we finally had a flute solo. And it was the first one that I ever played in public. In fact, I played it at Crazy Horse Memorial. And this was the time that I played a recital on which the first half I performed on the modern flute, followed it up with the Native American, and decided then and there that this was it. This was going to be the instrument of my choice.
All right, let's listen to Canto, written by James Pellerite and played by James Pellerite on the Native American flute. We have just heard James Pellerite play a piece called Canto on the instrument he now so dearly loves, the Native American flute. Now, I think you, although you continue to look forward as you develop this new field for yourself, I think it's important for us to go back and to find out how you started as a musician. Can you trace back to your childhood and your family? How did music enter into your life?
I come from an Italian family, of course, Sicilian to be exact. And this, of course, gives rise to the fact that some of my Native American flute exercises are extracted from the film music from The Godfather.
Oh.
they're perfect. And of course, I can express them since I have that background as well. So a Sicilian Indian, if you will. At any rate, my grandmother really was probably most influential in my early years because she insisted that that I was to be brought up with a certain amount of discipline, recognize the importance of hard work, and we never really had very much to begin with, but what we had, we valued greatly. And this was from the spiritual to the material.
And where was your childhood?
Clearfield, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
It's a town in the mountains of Pennsylvania. I think, as I remember my grandparents saying, they thought it resembled much of their area in Sicily, near Messina and Palermo. The most important thing, I think, was that instruments really couldn't be had, and they wanted me to start on some musical instrument. My uncle was a very gifted clarinetist who had been playing in the theaters, you know, for the silent movies. And he was a fantastic technician on the clarinet, but he didn't think that I ought to play the clarinet. He thought I ought to take up the flute because no one in the community played flute. Well, I never knew what the instrument was. Somehow, somebody located a piccolo that could be purchased for $5, and this was back in 1930, I believe. The instrument, I don't know how good it was. They all said it was pretty good. Here was a seven-year-old who finally came to the citizens' band. The Italians did always want a community organization, and they used the band for funerals. In fact, you see this in The Godfather, the parade during a funeral, always the tuba, the clarinets, the trumpets, but never really any piccolo. However, I became the solo piccolo since I was the only one in town playing that instrument. And so I was asked to play solos all over. And I remember instead of anybody giving me a few dollars to play, they gave me a gift of a box camera, a Kodak box camera, and this was incredible. I valued that so much. That was my first payment for playing a piccolo solo.
And then you had some formal training?
My uncle, the clarinetist, gave me a lesson every day. In essence, it was probably guiding a practice session. So it couldn't have been more disciplined from that standpoint. I didn't have a professional lesson until after the war, when I went to Juilliard and studied with Frederick Wilkins. He was my first professional teacher. Up until then, I was playing as a clarinetist had taught me, with all the bad habits you couldn't believe.
Well, you must have had talent, too, because you got to Juilliard. And then from there, you went into your orchestral era?
I didn't finish at Juilliard, unfortunately, because my teacher insisted that I should be going to Philadelphia to study with William Kincaid of the Philadelphia Orchestra. He insisted that that before I try any auditions, that I should study with him, which I thought was so noble. Frederick Wilkins was not only a great teacher, but a wonderful person. And he saw to it that I would be taken care of other than studying with him. In other words, he felt that he had done about as much as he could. I didn't agree. Nevertheless, I went to Kincaid for another year and then took my first audition for the Indianapolis Symphony.
And that was your first post?
Yes.
With the Indy. And who was the conductor at the time?
Fabian Savitsky.
And you stayed how long in Indianapolis?
2 years. And then I auditioned for the Detroit Symphony. They had shut down for a couple of years and then reorganized and actually hired people from New York. And in those days, the way it was done, the teacher would recommend a player for a job. And if you passed your audition, of course, you would get in. But there wasn't anybody else auditioning on that given day. It was entirely different from today's audition
system. Sure, students today would love that.
Yeah,
absolutely.
On the other hand, to get a recommendation was just as difficult.
Now, who was the conductor in Detroit?
The first year we had guest conductors, and this was fantastic because I had the opportunity to play with such luminaries as Bruno Walter, Dimitri Mitropoulos, Leopold Stokowski, Jean-El Perlea, Victor de Sabata, and Paul Perret. Ultimately, Paul Perret became the conductor.
It was quite a lineup. And then you stayed in Detroit?
From 1952 to 57, and then came to IU.
Now, where was Philadelphia?
Philadelphia was after I came to IU in 1960. That's when Kincaid retired.
So you came to IU, then left IU.
Only
went to Philadelphia
come back.
And then came back.
Yes.
Later. Ah, all
yes.
Right.
Yes.
Now, talk a little bit about the Philadelphia days. This was when Eugene Ormandy? Or?
Yes. This was still the period where you had to be recommended, but with Philadelphia, it was even more tightly controlled because he wouldn't hear anybody but Kincaid students. Fortunately, I had been studying with Kincaid off and on then from probably 1949 through 55, because I would, in the summers, go up to Maine and study with him. So I did continue my studies for several years with him.
Now, what was it like in the Philadelphia Orchestra under Ormandy? Must have been a heady experience for you.
Incredible. It was the pinnacle of my orchestral career, no question about that. Ormandy was a gentleman and a wonderful man to play for. And I believe that only now he's probably being appreciated even more for what he created musically. He was intelligent enough to realize when he took over from Stokowski that the Philadelphia Orchestra had a unique sound. He made it possible to retain that sound. And the freedom that he gave you in performance was something that would assist you in growing as a musician and instrumentalist.
How long did you stay in Philadelphia?
Unfortunately, just 1 year, because what happened was Dean Bain at that time insisted that I take a leave of absence. He said, we are just getting started. And it was so. In 1957, that was the period we were having people like Gingold and Farkas and Starker and Leonard Sharrow, Jerry Serucek. These were great people coming from all of the great orchestras. And he said, we're just getting started. You can't be staying in Philadelphia. In addition, the orchestras at that time were not paying anywhere near they pay now. So I was actually losing money by not being at IU. And we were just starting our family then. And the thought of having our two sons grow up in Bloomington certainly was very attractive.
Well, before we get back to Bloomington, let's go to another recording. And this is with orchestra, not the Philadelphia Orchestra, but the Moravian Philharmonic. And you are the soloist and on the Native American flute. And this is part of a piece called Dreams of the Child of Light by Michael Mauldin called Return to Lhasa. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Michael Mauldin is a composer living in Albuquerque. And how strange that all the while that we lived in Albuquerque, we never met. Yet, when we had moved a few years later to Colorado Springs, I connected with Michael through one of my former students who is on the faculty at Fort Lewis College in Durango. And she said, if you haven't met Michael Mauldin, you haven't gotten a piece that you should have. So I contacted Michael, and he said, I can't figure out what you're doing with the instrument. I've known of the Native American flute, but I can't imagine that it can do everything you say it can. So I said, well, I'd like to audition for you, Michael. So we went down to Albuquerque and had a wonderful visit. And he was taken by my capacities for producing some of these sounds, and he produced this piece that now is even the thematic section that you hear on my website.
All right, let's listen to Return from Lhasa, part of Dreams of the Child of Light by Michael Mauldin. We have just heard a portion of a piece by Michael Mauldin. Dreams of the Child of Light is the name of the piece. James Pellwright, our guest in the studio, was the soloist with the Moravian Philharmonic, conducted by Lawrence Golan. Let's go to Bloomington now, where you have spent many, many years. What caused you? Well, you told me already that money was one of the reasons, and Dean Bain's persistence was another. Were you happy to come back to academics?
Yes, I've always been fond of teaching, and at that time, of course, the universities were not as well equipped as they are today to function in a way that would recognize the arts as they do today. The main issue, I guess, was that there was much I wanted to do on the instrument, and playing in an orchestra was not really going to allow enough time for me to devote to the various things that I felt I should be doing. I enjoyed chamber music a lot, and of course, forming the Baroque Chamber Players here on the campus was something that I was very fond of. And unfortunately, when I left to go to Philadelphia, I really did miss it. Along with playing chamber music, of course, was the opportunity to be able to devote more time to develop more on the instrument itself. And during that period, we were also confronted with avant-garde music. And I connected with a composer and writer in Florence, Italy. His name was Bruno Bartolozzi. He wrote a book concerning avant-garde playing on the woodwinds. And I was fascinated by the fact that he began to experiment with multiphonics and quarter tones for the various instruments. However, as I studied his fingering charts in the book, I noted that there were some questions that would arise relative to the acoustics of the flute in this instance. And I began to think more about it, and I thought, what a wonderful way to advance this idea of using multiphonics and quarter tones by writing a book in which I could feature quarter tones and multiphonics that would respond properly according to the acoustical structure of the instrument. So this is when I began to work on my Modern Guide to Fingerings, which, by the way, is since it was published in 1970, and it's still used, and it's used throughout the world. Many composers turn to it, albeit multiphonics are not as widely used as they were, but at that time it was really referred to as the Bible for fingerings. And actually, if we stop to think for a moment and fast forward, much of that experience has now gone into my formulating the proper fingerings for the Native American flute.
Now, you must have also had satisfaction dealing with students, training them, sending them out into the profession.
This was a wonderful experience. I made a lot of friends, and I may have also made a few enemies. However, after many years, they've figured me out, and they have insisted that we're friends after all. I mean by that I guess I imposed such discipline in all of my students. Some of them took it much better than others. And I'm happy to say that those who did are really great players in major symphony orchestras today.
And then you retired, and then you came to this new part of your life. Let's talk about the commissioning that you've done, because you have attempted not only to make this instrument do your contemporary bidding, but you have commissioned composers to write for the instrument.
This, of course, had to be done because I had no music to play. Albeit I was so excited having the instrument, and I thought, well, how wonderful. Now I need to learn how to play this thing. But yet, that was only the beginning. I figured, okay, once I learn the scale, then what? What will I do with it? So I began to contact the various composers whose compositions I had been publishing for the modern flute. And I told them what I was up to, and their their first thought was, well, here's an instrument with five tones. Can you play any more than that? And of course, at that time, admittedly, I couldn't. But I thought for a moment and I said, I tell you, there must be more in there somewhere. We're going to find more tones. You write the piece and I'll promise to play it. They began, according to the range that I gave them based on the scale of the flute, they began to send pieces that I thought, oh, my heavens, I've shot myself in the foot again, because certainly I couldn't play a thing. But I didn't tell them this because I had no way of ascertaining if the pieces were really difficult or if it was simply that I couldn't play the instrument. So the more I worked, the better the pieces began to look. And before you know it, one piece begot the next, and so on it went. And the more pieces I received, the more the instrument developed technically. I say the instrument developed technically because here it is in its natural state of just a piece of wood with five tone holes. And I discovered early on that the embouchure for the native flute then, after all, would be the fingers, not the embouchure.
Well, let's try a piece that you commissioned, that you had written. It's by a gentleman named David Yeagley. And the piece as a whole is called Awakenings. You've selected something called Spirit's Dance. But could you talk about Mr. Yeagley? I understand he is a Native American.
Yes. He's a Comanche, and as he tells it, a descendant from a medicine man, Bad Eagle, of the Comanche tribe. I met David at a composers' conference in Aspen, Colorado. And at that time, I was going to give a session just on what I had been doing on the native flute and showing what a few composers had already done. So I, in essence, was trying to sell the idea of getting more composers involved. So what better way to do it but to go to a composer's conference? And I got a session scheduled. And after it was over, he raised his hand and he said, half of me says how wonderful, and half of me says you're prostituting the instrument. I really didn't know how to respond at that moment, except that I said, but it's certainly beautiful music that it's capable of making, whether or not I play tribal music or I play Stravinsky. So I insisted that the best way to fight is to join them. And I asked David if he would write a piece, and he said, oh my, no, I would never do that. We parted. A couple of weeks later, David's on the phone, and he said, you know, I've been thinking, maybe I'll experiment and write you a couple of solo pieces. A couple of solo pieces became 10 unaccompanied etudes, which he entitled as Awakening. And I asked him, David, can you play any of these pieces? Because they were written with such arduous, technical, acrobatic kinds of intervals. It called for fingerings to be coordinated in such a way that I had never experienced before. So the more I got into the pieces, the more I seemed to feel that it was accomplishing something for me. But at the same time, I was curious. I called him and I asked, David, can you play any of these pieces? And he says, oh, my, no, my flute doesn't play that way.
But now you have played it. And let's see how it sounds. This is James Pellerite playing Spirit's Dance, an etude for Native American flute by David Yeagley. We've heard James Pellerite in an etude called Spirit's Dance from a composition called Awakenings by David Yeagley. That's impressive music and impressively played, I must say. Where do you go from here?
Hopefully, with more performances and lectures, I'm going to give a recital to benefit the Helen and James Pellerite Flute Scholarship that has been inaugurated and will be awarded for the first time this coming academic year. The recital is going to be interesting in that I have as a guest performing with me Walfred Kujala, who is the retired piccolo soloist from the Chicago Symphony. He will play three works with me, specifically for modern flute and native flute, and two of these are chamber works that include percussion, viola, and cello, as well as modern flute and native flute.
Do you have more plans for the instrument?
Other than learning how to play it, Peter, I can't say that I have any specific plans because every day is a new day. I discover how to favor one note or help the intonation of another, or perhaps I hear a commercial with an interesting piece of background music that I'll extract as another exercise. Hopefully, maybe all of this will become a treatise one day, but then we have the problem, will anybody ever read it? Because I don't have many followers, unfortunately. The Native American flutists have not taken this up at all because they're convinced that culturally, their instrument belongs in this particular traditional state.
So the disciples are yet to come.
Yes.
Well, thank you, James Pellerite. Our guest today has been flutist James Pellerite, a man still on a mission to celebrate the Native American flute, but in a very different way from how it was initially perceived. For Profiles, this is Peter Jacoby.
The program you just heard was recorded in July of 2007. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Emily McCord was our research assistant. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.